So thanks a lot for the invitation and the opportunity to visit. So today I'm going to talk about some work that I've been doing over the last couple of years on trying to bridge the gap between certain formal or work that's been going on in the formal theory world, which goes under the name of conformal collider physics, with real-world LHC or collider phenomenology, in particular at the LHC. And this has gotten more interesting recently because a lot of these things which we proposed have actually been measured. And so I'll be able to show you kind of real comparisons between things which were predicted on the formal theory side and actual real LHC data, which is kind of fun. And so I should say, what I'm going to try and do here is just kind of give a broad overview of this work. So I'm not going to go into too much detail on either the kind of phenomenological side or on the formal side. And of course, there are certain people here who are experts at parts of this. And so if there's kind of additional details on certain parts, I'd be happy to discuss it more as we go along. Okay, so as everyone knows, the kind of canonical way of studying QCD collisions at, for example, the LHC, is to look in terms of jets, which are these sprays of particles clustered into groups to make everything infrared and collinear finite. And then you can study the kind of angles and kinematics of these jets. And so the reason one does that is that these are supposed to be reflective of the kind of kinematics of the quarks and gluons in the underlying microscopic scattering amplitude. And so this is obviously something which has been extremely successful. And so trying to obtain a precise description of these jet cross-sections has been a huge driver of theory developments, particularly in the amplitudes community. And it's really allowed us to learn a lot about quantum field theory. And so from my perspective, this has been a very kind of fruitful interplay between real phenomenological questions, which allow you to, for example, measure these huge variety of cross-sections in the standard model and actual advances in our understanding of quantum field theory. But if one looks at these collisions, this is just this kind of small part, either from a data analysis perspective or from a quantum field theory perspective. The underlying kind of hard scattering is just a small part of what one would like to understand. And you can ask a kind of different style of question that instead of looking at the kinematics of the individual jets, you can try and look at kind of patterns of the energy distribution inside individual jets. So for example, in this little picture, you could ask about the measurement of a correlation, kind of like you do in the CMB, for example, a three-point correlation of the energy depositions inside the jet. And so this tells you a very different type of information. Instead of being about the underlying hard scattering process, this is kind of telling you about the asymptotic or the late-time information that's deposited on the kind of sphere at infinity. And so the kind of origins of attempting to do this are very phenomenological in nature. And so this goes under the name of jet substructure. And so one of the reasons people started looking at this is, again, for extremely practical purposes, that if you have, for example, a Higgs which decays into hadrons, then the only way you can identify this is that you expect that it would imprint itself in some particular pattern in your detector. And so if you're an experimentalist that wants to look for this, you want to understand how the kind of microscopic objects, in this case Higgs, but if you have some beyond the standard model particle, how they imprint themselves in the kind of patterns of energy that you observe in your detector. And so this was kind of proposed experimentally in about 2008. And since then, there's been a lot of work to kind of better understand the structure of these observables in QCD, which has then become just of interest in its own kind of physical right, just for exploring or using this type of observables to explore quantum field theory. And so, of course, beyond searching, for example, for new physics, many more subtle questions, particularly about quantum chromodynamics, because that's the theory you can study most easily at colliders, are in some way imprinted in the collider flux. And so, for example, questions like confinement or about the structure of the quark-gluon plasma are something which are in some way imprinted into this asymptotic energy flux. And so what you really want to be able to do, particularly in these cases where the underlying phenomena is much more subtle, is have a sharp map between these kind of asymptotic observables and the properties of the underlying quantum field theory. And so you can kind of think about this kind of in cosmology, where what you're trying to do is to infer the kind of early or microscopic early time physics from these asymptotic or late time energy fluxes. And what you really want to do is kind of develop field theory techniques to really interpret these subtle correlations in terms of the dynamics of the underlying quantum field theory. So with that as motivation, what I'm going to talk about in the talk is I'll first begin with a kind of very brief overview of how one can try and decode this energy flux in terms of the underlying field theory. I'll then show how it leads to some very interesting scaling behavior when you just study kind of asymptotically free or nearly conformal theories like QCD at very high energies. And then you can really identify kind of, for example, critical exponents and actually measure these within jets at the LHC. And then depending on the time, I'll discuss this a little bit in more complicated systems where you insert some additional mass scale into the problem. And we'll see that these kind of imprint themselves in very nice ways as violations of this scaling behavior. Okay, so first, how do you want to talk about trying to decode this energy flux? So in condensed matter physics or cosmology, we understand how to do this very well. And in particular, we always decode the underlying dynamics using correlation functions. So for particularly in condensed matter systems, you measure correlation functions of local operators. And these are something that you learn very well how to deal with in, for example, quantum field theory classes. And so the nice thing about measuring some correlation function is it gives you a kind of natural ruler with which to compare the dynamics or that you're probing the dynamics of your system at. So if you measure a two-point correlation function, you can interpret the kind of bumps as dynamics happening at these particular scales. And so what we would like to do is to achieve kind of a similarly coherent picture for collider physics. And so if you want to do this, you actually kind of need to ask a very basic question. So of course, in the real world, this is what a picture of, for example, the CMS detector looks like. And so what you'd like to do is to ask, what is this as a quantum field theory operator? So for example, if you want to have a toy problem which you can study, or in some, for example, in your favorite field theory, you first need to make the kind of simplest version of this problem. And so what you're always doing in this system is you're kind of hitting something, in this picture illustrated with this hammer. And so this hammer we can always expand over a set of local operators which kind of create the disturbance which propagates out to our detectors. And then, so where there's been a lot of progress, particularly in the formal theory world in the last couple of years, is how to understand these camera operators which observe different fluxes coming off into your detectors. And so what we'd like to be able to do is to expand these cameras over another set of operators which are called detector operators, and I'll define these in a second. And so what this allows one to do is to kind of set up toy versions of this problem where you can really study them just as an abstract problem in quantum field theory. And so the first kind, the example which I'll mainly focus on in this talk is a kind of toy version of a calorimeter cell. So a calorimeter cell in an experiment measures the energy flux going in a particular direction. And so this is something which has kind of floated around in the literature for a while, but was made particularly popular in the work of Hoffman and Maldacena. And in particular, one can give a kind of field theory definition of a calorimeter cell, which is just as shown here, where you take the stress tensor in your theory. So you dot it into some particular direction, which the energy flux is going to go to. You then integrate over all time, because you just imagine your detector is kind of sitting there as the fluxes go through. And then you move the detector off to infinity. And depending on your liking, you can either think of this as a local point on your detector, like a calorimeter cell, or in the kind of Penrose diagram picture, which emphasizes this integral over time. It really shows that it's a kind of a line operator, a non-local operator in the quantum field theory. And so then what you're really doing in, let's say, jet substructure at the LHC is you're trying to measure correlation functions of these energy flow operators. So you produce some state, for example, through colliding protons, and then you want to measure, for example, a three-point correlation function of these objects. And so the reason why this is nice is this now kind of abstracts the problem that we're trying to do at the LHC, and you can just study this correlation function in whatever theory you want. And in particular, you can use, for example, symmetries or whatever you want to try and study it. And so just to put this in kind of a broader context, so these correlation functions take kind of an intermediate role or an intermediate position between amplitudes and correlation functions. And so this will be nice for us because we'll be able to use kind of techniques from both sides to do this computation. So of course, the nice thing about correlation functions of local operators is they're kind of, in this language, infrared finite, so they're non-perturbatively well-defined observables. But they're not nice because they don't have asymptotic states, which are what obviously you have in a detector. On the other hand, scattering amplitudes by themselves are extremely beautiful. But unfortunately, they're infrared, or by themselves, they're not, or infrared, you have to deal with asymptotic states. And so in massless theories, these are not well-defined. And so instead, you need to use these kind of jets, which I described earlier, which kind of obscure some of the beauty of the actual scattering amplitude. And so these energy correlators take a kind of intermediate position where they're essentially correlation functions where one of the operators is asymptotic. And so these have both asymptotic states, but they're IR finite or non-perturbatively well defined observables. And in particular, you can borrow many of the techniques, for example, from the scattering amplitudes worlds to, for example, perform integrals and study the structure of these objects. But despite this kind of physical importance, in particular that you can directly measure them, they're much less explored compared to either of these two objects, which of course everyone has heard about all the great advances in those areas. And so this is kind of this toy version of these observables. And so one can ask, can this kind of theoretical idealization possibly work in the kind of messy real world of hadron colliders? So for example, the LHC or in some heavy ion collider. And more importantly, can it provide new ways of understanding these complex collisions? And so my hope will be to convince you that it actually can. And so just to kind of illustrate the kind of thing that one can get out, and I'll go through in more detail what this means as we go throughout the talk. But so this is a measurement of this two-point correlation function inside a high-energy jet. And so it's a function of the angle between the two detectors, which here, because it comes from a hadron collider, is denoted RL, but you should just think of it as the angle on the sphere between the two detectors. And so you can see that it exhibits this very interesting behavior as a function of the angle. So at large angles, or relatively large angles, it exhibits this universal scaling law, which is reflective of the interacting quarks and gluons at very high energies. So here it has a non-integer scaling, which you can compute in perturbation theory, and it exhibits non-trivial higher point, like 3- and 4-point correlations coming from these interacting quarks and gluons. Then at some scale, you hit the confinement transition. So you have a reorganization of the degrees of freedom, which you can see is almost kind of like a phase transition. So it very abruptly breaks this scaling. And then you transition on this side. So this scaling is just a geometric scaling, which is what you'd get for like uniformly distributed balls. So it's just a purely geometric factor. And so this is non-interacting hadrons. So you have integer scaling, and you have all trivial higher point correlations. And so you can really, from kind of measurements, just the energy flux coming out into your detector, see, for example, the confinement transition, and extract, as I'll show later, like numerical values for these scaling coefficients. And so it gives a very kind of nice way of studying QCD, and you can kind of nicely see asymptotic freedom and confinement in this one plot. And so we'll kind of work through, for example, how one can actually compute these scaling exponents, and so hopefully this global picture will make a bit more in the detailed aspects make more sense as we go throughout the talk.
What's the virtual axis morphology?
So this is just the cross section for this two-point correlation function. So it's really, so what you like an experiment, what you're really doing, you can think of it just like in the CMB, you just take you're just looking for all pairs of particles as a function of this angle. And so it's telling you how many pairs of particles there are distributed as a function of the angular scale size. And so it says it rises for a while, which is associated with the kind of collinear singularity in QCD. And then you have the confinement scale, and then it falls off with just a geometrical factor, which is just reflective of non-interacting hadrons.
So how many jets do you average?
So this is over a huge data set. And so this is it's an ensemble average over a particular class of jets. So this would have millions and millions and millions of jets. And so that's just related to, like in the definition earlier, you're really doing as an ensemble average over this. And so you have to assume that, and so that will leave some statistical fluctuations, but you're really assuming you can ensemble average over a very large set of jets with some particular kinematic restrictions.
That's a physical scale, so that's an angle. That's literally.
This is an angle. So exactly. So good. So you can convert this to a dimensionful parameter, which I'll describe later. But the dimensionful parameter is essentially the energy of the jet times this angle. And so if you convert this, you'll find that this is exactly like lambda QCD. So it's like a bit below a GeV.
Then doesn't mean that you need to have, in the detector, you need to have like inverse GeV, the position discrimination, that doesn't.
Yeah.
Because the calorimeter cell is probably much bigger.
So this is measured on tracks. So you can do it. So these can be measured to very, very high. So this is one of the things. So one of the very nice things that you can do at the LHC. So if you look at the So this observable was proposed and measured like at LEP, but there, like the entire bin was like the size of this. They just had like one big data point for this. And so the very nice thing is with modern detectors, you can really resolve this. So that's it requires extremely good angular resolution, and they seem to be able to do it. And so exactly as you said, what it means is below this, you don't have correlations below the like the GV scale. And that's just because then things have just formed into hadrons, and so you don't have like sub confinement correlations. But you'll see like the LHC, they can go to like 10 to the minus like 4 or so in angle. So they can do really, 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 they have very impressive detectors. Okay, so now what I want to do is just kind of work through some of the aspects of this plot. And so in particular, the kind of most striking feature, at least from, or that we'll be able to compute and understand in perturbative QCD, is this uniform scaling behavior on this side of the plot. So that's where we can actually do calculations. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But if I look at just like the analytic
good. So you mean if you take like one jet and just do this?
Yeah.
So it depends. So at very high multiplicity, you can, and you'll just get like a noisy version of this plot. And so for these jets, these have, I don't know, like 30 or 40 particles, it will be extremely noisy. But you do definitely see something, and what it's telling you about like those fluctuations are about like higher point, they're encoding like higher point of these functions, which are encoding the fluctuations in the 2-point. But you'll see something, but you definitely cannot see it this sharply. And so part of what the experimentalists can do now is they have extremely good data, and so you can really get like very, very good error bars so it really relies on having these huge samples of jets at the LHC. Yeah, but yeah, good question, thank you. Okay, so the first thing we want to understand a little bit is about this scaling behavior of quarks and gluons. And so the kind of motivation for this is, and a kind of nice thing that one can compare to, is for example, the critical exponents that one extracts for example, phase transitions. And so at least for me, this is also a nice analogy because you have these very macroscopic systems. But the thing that is neat is that if you perform measurements of specific quantities, you can actually extract anomalous dimensions of the underlying microscopic theory. So you can really measure from these kind of very macroscopic systems, microscopic dynamics of the underlying theory. And so this is what we also want to do for QCD at the LHC. And so the thing which is quite neat, which was originally postulated by Hoffman and Malacena, and then has been developed in quite some detail, is that these energy flow operators also admit an operator product expansion, which is called the light ray OPE. And the way one should think about this is in terms of these kind of camera detectors, is if you bring two of these cameras together, you can expand them over another set of cameras. And so although these detectors, which will appear on this side, are not kind of physical detectors, which an experimentalist can build, they're detectors, and I'll write some of them down later, which they detect some kind of state. And so in particular, the nice thing that this predicts is that as you bring two of these detectors together, it predicts, much like the Euclidean OPE, a uniform scaling behavior, but now in the angle between the two detectors. And so this holds in a conformal theory or a theory with kind of a weakly broken conformal symmetry. And so this is very neat because it predicts universal scaling behavior and the fluctuations in the energy. And the other thing, which is why it's extremely useful computationally, is that if you know the set of detectors here, you just need to compute these anomalous dimensions. And so these are objects which have been computed to quite high perturbative orders, and so will allow us to compute some fairly complicated correlation functions in terms of kind of break them down in the standard way that one does for higher point functions of local operators, and predict scaling behaviors of things which one is not able to compute using standard perturbative techniques. And so this is kind of one of the most, one could argue, basic predictions of quantum field theory for jet substructure. And there's this kind of interesting exchange for motivating some of this work. That when this was originally presented, Polchinski kind of asked, like, there's a huge amount of collider physics data. They've been doing this for a long time. So can you go out and look at this scaling? And so this is an actual transcript. And so at that time, there was this kind of disconnect between the formal and the, so this is right when the LHC was kind of turning on. And this was then kind of completely forgotten. And so it's something that could have been done very and should have been done at that time, but was just kind of completely forgotten. And as I said, this is not quite historically true because people proposed to do this long ago at LEP, but then the kind of energies of the jets were too low to really be in this truly asymptotically free regime. And the detectors were so bad that you could not see things. And so this kind of lay dormant for quite some time. But now, with the kind of modern LHC data, it's worthwhile to go through and understand what you'd actually predict from this light ray operator product expansion at the LHC. And so I'm not going to go through this in too much technical detail, but I just want to highlight why in QCD this is very, or we can do this in a very effective manner. And so in conformal field theories, this light ray operator product expansion is actually a convergent and rigorous expansion. So you can construct the full set of operators that appear here, and they're organized by the twist of those operators, and this is actually a convergent expansion. So the reason why this is nice in QCD is if we're really measuring very small angles, and so this relates to your question, so in these plots we're really measuring like 10 to the minus 2 or so angles, the leading operator in QCD has twist 2, and so this predicts a kind of 1 over power law scaling, and so you really only need to know the leading twist 2 behaviors if you want to make phenomenological predictions. So we're interested in doing this only inside jets where the angle is very small, and so this gives a natural and very simple expansion because you just take the leading term. And so it's very easy to understand what are these called, these twist 2 light ray operators, which are what is going to dominate the scaling behavior. And so if we want to understand the scaling behavior of generic endpoint functions, all we need to do is understand these twist 2 light ray operators in QCD, and this is a very manageable thing to do. And so I'm not going to go, again, into too much detail, but so these will essentially be the new cameras which appear on the right-hand side of this operator product expansion. And so as people know, for example, from in Peskin and Schroeder or something, if you look at local operators, so in general, these twist 2 operators in QCD are characterized by a spin J and then a transverse spin, which can be 0 or 2. And so these are just the kind of familiar twist 2 operators in QCD. So you have one which you can think of, or one kind of quark operator and one gluon operator. And then you have one that really has some transverse spin dependence, which I'll neglect for now. So if you're just looking at these two operators, you can think of these as kind of, loosely speaking, a detector that detects quarks and an object that detects gluons. And so just like how we took the stress tensor and integrated it along this null ray, we can do the similar thing for these quark and gluon operators, but now separately and not combined in the particular way that they are in the stress tensor. And so this gives us two operators, or one quark and one gluon, for every value of the spin J. And so these are the kind of leading twist light ray operators, which will appear in this operator product expansion. And the anomalous dimensions of these operators, which are well-known objects, so these are known in QCD to like four loops, these will determine the leading behavior of all these jet substructure, or the leading scaling behavior of these jet substructure observables. And so if one can do this operator product expansion into these leading twist 2 operators, then you can identify the scaling behavior of various correlators. And so I'll just skip over. You have to do a little bit of extra work to do this in the actual states of the LHC, which I'll skip over, and just go to this particular result, which is shown here. And so if you now do this, so you can just compute these anomalous dimensions in QCD and compare what you get with the scaling behavior. So this is just the zoomed in version of the right-hand side of that plot, which I showed before. So you get this very nice scaling behavior in this perturbative regime. And you can really compute in perturbation theory. So this is just a different orders in perturbation theory. And you can definitely go much higher. And you see this kind of beautiful agreement between the actual data and these theoretical calculations. And so the very nice thing about this is in a real kind of messy Hadron Collider environment. But if you ask this kind of specific universal question, you observe this very nice scaling behavior. And so it's a nice way where you can really extract this scaling behavior from a measurement. Yeah.
So I guess like in here, like is the how the RS involves energy? Like,
yes.
So like, is there like a, does this mean like you have a measurement of high stress strong?
Yeah, so I'll show, yeah, so I will show that in a second. Yeah, so this is a very zoomed out version. So this is dominated here by the classical scaling. And so what we'll do in a second is look for the actual anomalous scaling, which is directly proportional to alpha s, and then you can extract the value of alpha s. Yeah, so I'll do this in the next couple slides. And so this is just to show this one is that this has now been measured in the last few months by a whole variety of collaborations. And so related to your question, the very neat thing, and this is just a mess of a plot, but this is just to show that they've done it. We'll go into more detail in a second. But it's been measured all the way from 15 GeV at some of these more nuclear colliders all the way up to approximately 2 TeV. So you've really been able to measure it over a huge range of energies, which will be useful for exactly your question of extracting the strong coupling constant. And so one question, so in this plot, this is dominated by, or if I show up above in this OPE, sorry, this is dominated by this power law scaling, this 1 over, so this is twist 2 approximately. This goes like 1 over theta squared. And so this is dominated by this integer kind of classical scaling. But this has higher order corrections proportional to strong coupling. And so one would like to understand if one can really identify the kind of corrections to the anomalous dimensions in QCD. And so it turns out that one very nice way of doing this, sorry, is that this light ray OPE predicts that if you have generic for an endpoint correlation function, or in particular if I consider a J minus 1 point correlation function, what appears are the twist 2 spin J operators. So if I try and scale a generic correlation function, each of these has a different anomalous dimension or a different scaling as a function of energy. And so if you take the ratio of these to the 2-point function, you cancel out this classical piece, and it's just proportional to the difference of the twist to anomalous dimensions for different values of J. So in the classical theory, this would just be flat. And so what this allows you to do is to exactly extract the kind of differences of these anomalous dimensions. And so on this, in this plot, you can see these are the ratios of, for example, the 6-point, 5-point, 4-point, and 3-point correlators all to the 2-point. And you can see that they exhibit these slopes. So these are just the differences in anomalous dimensions. And so this also kind of clearly sees that the anomalous dimensions for the higher point correlation functions are larger. And so this is just this monotonicity of these anomalous dimensions. And so you can really probe the spectrum of the twist two light ray operators that are kind of forming the structure of these energy fluxes by directly looking at these correlation functions. And so the other kind of neat thing about this is it's currently not possible to compute, for example, the 6-point correlation function in QCD. But by using this operator product expansion, you can extract its scaling behavior in a very clean way, and that anomalous dimension can be accurately computed. And so it kind of bypasses having to brute force compute some of these. And you can just extract from this OPE these kind of very nice properties. And so these endpoint or these ratios of correlation functions have also been measured over this entire energy range shown here. And so in particular, they've been measured by CMS to extremely high, as I mentioned, about 2 TeV energy scales. And so you can see that what the prediction of these is that these should scale with this difference of anomalous dimensions shown here. And you can see that these all exhibit this very nice power law scaling, as would be predicted. But you can also directly see the running of the coupling, which is related to your question. So in a conformal field theory, all these slopes would be the same. But you can see that these are much steeper at lower energy and then kind of become more and more mellow at increasingly high energy as the coupling diminishes. And so you can really kind of accurately measure this quant or these anomalous scaling dimensions. And so one thing which you can,
what information is there, like in the shape of the
stream? I will come, to, so that will be the, so this is just the scaling, and the next section will be the shape. Yeah, so that's a very good question, yeah. So one thing which is just for fun is from these slopes, you can really see by eye the kind of running of the coupling in QCD. And so you can really, so this is just, yeah, asymptotic freedom by eye. But the thing which is more interesting is you can actually extract at a very precise level the value of the coupling constant by comparing theoretical predictions to these slopes. And so this was done, I guess, last month, where they extracted this value of the strong coupling. So it's to about a 4% accuracy, which is by far the best from jet substructure. And so this actually compares quite competitively, even though it's kind of a first attempt at this, with record. So in this is a kind of PDG tabulation of extractions of the value of the strong coupling constant with their uncertainties kind of shown in yellow. And then in this red, which I've added on, is the value extracted from this measurement along with its uncertainty. And so one can see that this is, it's not the kind of best ever extraction, but it's getting, it's in the ballpark of those uncertainties. And so the nice thing with this is can be done at higher, so this is, it can be done better on the experimental side and also on the theoretical side. And it's a proof of principle that one can really use these very high energies and the very nice detectors to actually try and resolve some of the previous discrepancies in these measurements of alpha S. And so this is something which previously people had focused on E plus E minus, where it was easier to compute, and there'd been difficulties in doing this at the LHC just because it's a much more complicated environment. But by kind of isolating this very simple scaling behavior, the hope is that this can really be pushed to higher perturbative orders. And it just kind of shows that one is in the ballpark, and one can do better. OK, so now related to your question, so the next thing one would like to do is not just understand the scalings, but actually try and understand the shape dependence of higher point correlation functions. And so of course, this is very similar to in, for example, cosmology, where what you're really trying to do is to measure non-Gaussianities or higher point interactions. And so what you really want to do is to understand the shape of these higher point correlation functions and not just their scaling behavior, which is just predicted by the anomalous dimensions. And so later, particularly for studying applications to systems which we do not understand as well, such as the quark-gluon plasma, or for extracting masses of top quarks, I'll show that what one really wants to look for in those cases is modifications to the shape. And so what we first want to do is to understand in just perturbative QCD, what is the shape dependence of these higher point correlation functions. And so kind of disturbingly, so the only explicit results, so for amplitudes, you have this huge wealth of beautiful perturbative data. But unfortunately, for these correlation functions, the only explicit results for correlators with greater than 2 were these very nice results by Hoffman and Maldacena in their original paper as an expansion in the strong, or in 1 over the coupling, but an expansion about the strong coupling limit in n equals 4 super young mills using ADS-CFT. And so they were able to give this remarkable prediction for the generic endpoint correlation function. But this is really, as I said, an expansion of a strong coupling. So you'll see the leading term is 1. So it's just this uniform behavior. And so this is very, or it's kind of expanding about the exact opposite limit of kind of QCD or weak coupling jets, where you expect to have this kind of perturbative structure of these different quarks and gluons. And so what we would like to do is to apply some of the very nice techniques from the amplitudes world, in particular computing integrals, to compute the structure of some of these objects at weak coupling. And so I apologize to certain people here who are experts at computing integrals. So I'll just give a very basic exposition of why these are kind of nice objects. And so I just wanted to illustrate why these things have a nice structure when you try and compute them in perturbation theory. And then I'll show some of the results. So if you want to try and compute one of these objects in perturbation theory, so remember that these detectors had an integral over time, which is just an integral over the energy fraction arriving in your detector. So let's say you wanted to compute this three-point correlation function. At lowest order in perturbation theory, what you have to do is to integrate some matrix element, which describes the 1-to-3 splitting, against some energy weights, which are just constrained to add up to 1. And so you have an integral of this particular form here, where this matrix element is a function of these omega variables and the angular structure. And so if we just take as a very simple illustration, the case where this 1-to-3 splitting function is just 1 over S123, so it's just a propagator. And so more generally, it'll just be products of Mandelstam invariants. So the very nice thing about this is that once you fix the angles on the sphere, you can write them in terms of some variable that doesn't really matter, of these zijs, which just parameterize the distance on the sphere. And you just get these very nice integrals of this form, where each of these is a bilinear or a quadratic in these energy fractions. And so you just get integrals of this particular form shown here. And so if you look at this, this is just immediately recognized as a kind of Feynman parameter integral, where you can interpret these distances as just dual coordinates for the momentum in your scattering amplitude. So this really just takes, it looks kind of by eye, almost exactly like a Feynman parameter integral. And so this one is simple enough that it actually is directly related to a specific loop integral. So in this case, you can really just map it back to a well-known loop integral. More generally, you don't have to be able to do this, but it just gives a very nice class of finite integrals, which you can do using a lot of the nice techniques which have been developed in the amplitudes world. So in particular, compared to many other observables, the structure of these integrals is relatively well understood, and you can apply all the nice machinery that has been developed on the amplitude side. And so compared to what's been done there, these integrals are quite trivial, but it's nice that they appear in kind of physical observables. And so if you do this in n equals 4, you can, it's actually quite a simple calculation, and you get a very nice compact answer for the leading structure of these observables. And so depending on your taste, so it's expressed in terms of a few very simple polylogarithmic functions. And so the nice thing, at least to me, is that this is an actual physical observable. So this is really describing the kind of structure of energy flux in your detector. And so you can really go out and actually measure this shape dependence. So this is distinct from like amplitudes where you have to square it and do this other stuff. This is really describing the correlations as a function of these kinematic parameters, or as a function of the shape of this triangle. So this is parameterized in terms of some cross ratios, which don't matter exactly. But you can really just go out and try and measure this three-point correlation function and compare with kind of nice analytic results what you have for this object. And so this is the result in n equals 4. The result in QCD just has some more polynomials, but the functions that appear are the same. And so you can also extend this game. So you can, once you have it at 3 points, you can try and do it more generally. Because as I said, these define a very nice class of finite integrals. And so more recently, we did this up to 4 points. So in particular, this was done with Kai Yan and Emery Sokachev, who are experts at getting both the very compact forms for this 1-to-4 splitting function in n equals 4. And then Kai, who's extremely good at doing these integrals. And so we were really able to obtain a nice compact expression in terms of, in this case, weight 3 polylogarithms for this 4-point correlation function in n equals 4 supremum mils. So it's kind of a fun place to explore the structure or the perturbative structure in real physical observables, which you can measure the LHC.
I have a simple
Yeah.
So as you said, these are not like cross-section measurements. These are correlation function measurements.
But you should view them as weighted cross-sections. So they're really like, they are like squared cross-section level observables where you've just applied a weight to the cross-section.
My question was, is there factorization when you measure correlation functions as opposed to just measuring like cross-sections?
Yeah, so these will obey, like you'll have all the same factorization properties of standard amplitudes. And so they'll obey, for example, like as you bring these together, they'll obey a kind of collinear factorization. So all those standard properties will obey.
In factorization also with the initial state.
Yeah, and so they'll factorize. So I skipped over a little bit how one really does this at the LHC, but you can prove factorization theorems for these observables just like you do for other cross-section level observables. Yeah. And so you should really think of them, because if you think that you're producing the cross-section and then you're like summing over pairs weighted by their energies. And so they're sometimes referred to as like weighted cross-sections. So it's like the simplest thing is like an inclusive cross-section, and then this is like a weighted cross-section. So it's like the next best thing to an inclusive cross-section. But yeah, it's a very good question. And so as I said, the fun kind of thing about this is you can really go out and just directly measure the shape dependence of these higher point correlation functions inside jets at the LHC. So for example, this is a measurement of this 3-point correlation function. So these are some variables which parameterize the shape, which are loosely related to the kind of angle and the side length. So it's a bit hard to visualize, but kind of in this region down here, there's what is sometimes referred to as a collapsed triangle. Up here is this equilateral region, and then here, down here, is this squeeze region. So here, this has been normalized to the 2-point function. So it's something that's called the non-Gaussianity. You see that in this exactly is kind of related to your question. So in this limit where it's these two are squeezed, it factorizes into a product of 2-point functions. And so this non-Gaussianity, which is normalized to the product of 2-point functions, exactly goes to 1. And so you can kind of see this factorization structure. And then they're not factorizing in this kind of equilateral region where they're not reducing to a product of lower point functions. And so that kind of illustrates a little bit in this result, this factorization. But more generally, you can really prove factorization properties for these objects. And so this is the actual measurement in CMS. And then this is compared to our calculation in QCD. And you can see, at least at lowest order, so this can definitely be improved. But you can see kind of one is actually you can calculate these higher point correlation functions. And you actually have control over them, which is kind of fun. And it's also just you can plot these nice things that you compute analytically. And they really agree with what you measure directly in your detector. So it's kind of a fun. OK, so now what I want to do is to apply these to trying to. So these are in pure massless perturbative QCD, where we should just be able to understand everything. And it's more just illustrating that we can compute these things and we have control over them. So now what we want to do is to kind of use them as probes of more complicated systems that we don't understand. And so QCD is a very kind of rich theory that has a lot of both intrinsic and emergent scales. So for example, you can put directly in heavy quarks, such as the top quark. Or as I said earlier, you have the emergent scale of confinement, or scales in the quark gluon plasma, or in large nuclei. And so what you want to do is to use these correlators, which you understand very well in pure perturbative QCD, use them in these more complicated systems, and then understand how these new scales, or systems that you don't understand very well because they're non-perturbative, like the quark gluon plasma, so how these imprint themselves into the asymptotic energy flux. And so I'll just go through a couple examples illustrating these. And so for the most part, you lose perturbative control, except in the top quark case. And so what you're really doing is trying to understand something about the system or something about the more complicated emergent scale, given your understanding of the perturbative one. So I'll just check how much time I have. OK. And I'll go through this relatively quickly because I'm coming close to time. So what I wanted to illustrate this on is just this confinement transition, which I showed at the very beginning, using this to measure precisely the top quark, and then using this in the quark gluon plasma. And again, hopefully, in many of these cases, we'll use explicitly modifications to the shape dependence of these higher point correlators. And so that's why having them under control in QCD is very nice. OK, so the first one, which I'll go through quickly, is just this hadronization process. And so this one was the exact plot which I showed already, although hopefully now it makes more sense what is actually being seen in this plot. So now we understand that we can directly measure the scaling behavior on this side. And so one can interpret in like a conformal theory. It would just go on forever. And so we can now easily interpret the emergent scale of confinement as really imprinting itself into this. And we can read off and understand its dynamics. And so unfortunately, right now, we have no model where we can actually compute this turnover. And so but this just shows that one can kind of experimentally measure, for example, the properties of this turnover in different theories and try and understand something about that transition. But ideally, you'd like to also be able to have some model where you can interpret that in your theory. And so you can just immediately, by eye, see the presence of this transition imprinted in the correlator. So the second example is that one can try and use this to measure the weight of the top quark. And so the top quark is one of the kind of very important parameters of the standard model. For example, for electroweak vacuum stability, criticality, electroweak fits, et cetera. And so one of the problems is because it's strongly interacting, it's very hard to precisely define its mass in field theory. And so you really need observables where you can prove factorization theorems. And so this is related to your question. And so what you really want are the simplest observables with top mass sensitivity that you can compute from first principles field theory. And so one thing you can do, and again, this picture is quite complicated, but because the top primarily decays into this three-point correlation function, you can try and measure the full shape dependence of this three-point correlation function on top decays. And so if you do this, it actually has an extremely complicated structure. And the way that one can think about this is that there's two regimes inside this correlation function. So there's one where you really have a hard decay of the top. And so if you're like familiar with how these things imprint in cosmology, you can think of this as adding some like heavy, higher dimensional operator here. And it really decays into a kind of an equilateral region and is peaked near the value of the top mass in an equilateral triangle regime. You also have a regime where you really see the presence of the on-shell W. And you kind of have, or I showed a bit better in this earlier plot, where you kind of have this factorization and this squeeze limit where the W actually propagates, and you have some angular scale at the scale of the W mass. And so the reason why this is important is you can then take the kind of ratio of the cross-section in these two regions, because of the LHC, you cannot measure well the energy of the jet. And what that gives you is a direct measurement of the value of the top mass relative to the value of the W mass, which is known extremely well. So you can use this as kind of a standard candle to calibrate these measurements. And so though I won't go through all the kind of details, you can do a kind of simulation of this or a projection of this for the high luminosity LHC. And we're optimistic that you can actually get measurements down at the kind of 0.3 GeV scale. And so this is something which you can really, and where more help from perturbative QCD people will come in, but you can really compute these things very accurately and try and get an extract or a precision top mass extraction in systems where you understand things very well.
Here, one second, there the axis and the horizontal axis exactly. So
in this. So this is the full 3-point correlation function, the shape dependence. And then these are certain projections of it. So you can see in here, you kind of have multiple peaks. So this one is very complicated. And you can see it's kind of projected onto different axes. And you can read off, for example, there's something with the W peak, and then the top peak. And then these are kind of slices of this projected on. So you can see it a bit more easily by eye. And so you can then read off the values of the W and the top. And by taking their ratio, you can actually extract physical parameters from these angular parameters. But this is something where really having the shape dependence of these higher point correlators is very useful phenomenologically. And so just very quickly, because I'm running out of time, I'll show how you can use this a little bit to understand the quark gluon plasma. So this is something where you lose complete perturbative control. But the way one can think about it, so what we're going to try and do is we're going to kind of shoot these perturbative quarks and gluons through some very energetic or some quark gluon plasma. And so the way you can imagine this, although it's, of course, more complicated, is having some little ball of quark gluon plasma in the middle. And what you want to do is to, for example, or first just detect that it's there just through the correlations in the energy flux at infinity. So the simplest question you can ask, and then you'd want to do more, but is first if you can just see the presence of this very small ball of plasma in the asymptotic energy flux. And so it turns out you can actually do this very clearly because you explicitly have the measurement as a function of scale. So the way you can think about this is kind of very similar to ADS-CFT, that at very small angles, at least at leading order, what happens is you have some particle which is on shell, so it propagates a very long way, in particular out of the plasma, and then splits near the boundary into your detector. And so in this case, you should get a scaling behavior which is almost the same as in the vacuum. And then what you do is you just kind of separate these detectors, and you force the splitting to go back. And at some point, it will enter the plasma, and you should see an abrupt change in the scaling behavior. And so this is just a simulation. So this will hopefully, or the measurement has now been done in heavy ion, but it's not out yet. But you can see that at very small angles up here, you just get this vacuum scaling. And then you get this big abrupt transition as you enter the plasma. And then by measuring, so either by measuring the kind of height of this bump is sensitive to the transport parameters, or you can measure higher point correlation functions in this regime to extract kind of properties of the quark gluon plasma. And I'll skip this one. But just as one more kind of thing which one can do, where you actually use the shape dependence of these higher point correlation functions. So this is a simulation of the shape dependence of the 3-point correlation function. So again, it's plotted in these angular and size variables. And so this is the result in essentially vacuum, where you can see the standard collinear singularity. And it's quite suppressed in this equilateral region because there's nothing generating kind of wide angle interactions. And then you can see that when you add in the presence of the, so in this case, it's called the wake, but essentially of the quark gluon plasma, you can see this huge enhancement in this particular region. And so you're really kind of detecting the shape of the wake as some kind of jet plows through it. And so the hope is that by measuring these, you can really kind of unravel the kind of structure of these interactions. And this is where kind of being able to compute these and their shape dependence and perturbative QCD is extremely helpful. And so these, of course, you only have some models. So this is using some strongly or model by Krishna, where it uses an n equals 4 model for the background plasma. So it's, of course, not realistic. But then by measuring an experiment, you can kind of extract certain parameters of this. And so just to summarize, and sorry if I went over time, so hopefully I convinced you that some of these nice insights from formal theory are really making an impact on very phenomenological questions in collider physics. And so the reason why there's this kind of nice overlap is that this jet substructure provides kind of a physical realization of this operator product expansion limit of light ray operators, where you're really sensitive to the kind of universal physics and not the kind of initial state. And so this gives a nice bridge between kind of field theory developments and QCD phenomenology. And hopefully some of these energy correlator measurements will allow us to understand these more complicated systems, such as top quarks or the quark gluon plasma. And so, yeah, thank you. Yeah, so unfortunately I didn't show, but so if you go, so essentially what a B-jet looks like is it just imprints itself at the scale of a B, and so it looks almost like this one in terms of shape, but if you have like a massless jet where this is at lambda QCD, so you get, for a B-jet, it has a, you can think of it as being in the UV, it has the exact same scaling or the same anomalous dimensions, and then it just turns over earlier at the scale of MB.
And that is already
measured? Well, so this one has been, I didn't show it, it has been measured by the, it's not published yet, but it has been measured by the collaborations. And so it does exhibit this behavior, yeah.
Does this behavior like allow you to also measure the mass of the top?
So the top is a bit different because of the structure of its decay. So in particular, the B decays into like a, like a B, it's just the structure of the decay is a little bit different. So in the top case, you really need to do this three particle correlation function.
So like B is already in some sort of a mesolite decay?
Or it's more, yeah, the structure of this, it's because the top really has this like hard three-body decay. And so it really imprints itself in this like three-point structure. And so you cannot, because the top goes through the W, that sets another time scale, which kind of obscures this if you just measure the two-point correlation. And so there you really need to go to the three-point correlation. Whereas from this, for the B and things that just go directly through, you can really just measure it from the two-point correlation.
So like this lesson will also allow you to measure the mass of the W.
So you can do this, but the problem is the mass of the W is extremely well, yeah. So in principle, yes. But so where this helps because is for like large multiplicity final states, where you want to extract the mass from those high multiplicity kind of final states in some way that you have under theory control. So for the W, there's like, you'll never compete. And so that's why one can use it as like a standard candle. Same as for the B, this is just, you'll never compete with other ways of getting the B mass because you can just be done like using spectroscopically much better. But this is more just kind of illustration. And again, or the kind of nice thing about this is that in this case, you cannot compute this turnover because you've lost perturbative control. So in this case, you have this turnover at the mass of the B, and so you have it under perturbative control. And so you can really compute this turnover in perturbation theory. And so it's just kind of a, it's like a, an example where you have it a bit under better theoretical control.
You showed like the operator for quarks and gluons.
Yeah. So yeah, good. So like the problem is this is always an so if I go back to, for example, these like shape dependences. So the anomalous dimensions here are really like eigenvalues, and then you have an essentially a different anomalous dimension for quark and for gluon. And so as you change the like quark gluon fraction, you'll really get different slopes. And so for like gluon jets, the anomalous dimension is larger. For quark jets, it's smaller. And so if you like, you can either view this as like, so here we can compute the fraction of quark and gluons going in and use it to extract the value of alpha s. If you knew, you can say the other way, that if you knew the value of alpha s, then you could back extract the fraction of quark and gluons. So it just depends which way you want to do it. But the scaling does depend on whether it's predominantly the quark operator that's driving things or whether it's predominantly the gluon operator that's driving things. And there's kind of a fun, so of course the other thing which I completely glossed over is this is not really true in a non-conformal theory because you also have the beta function. And there's actually a very fun effect that it kind of matters the size of this anomalous dimension relative to the beta function. So like for gluon jets, the anomalous dimension is much bigger than the beta function, and so it really looks almost exactly like a CFT. For quark jets, if you have pure quark jets, the beta function is actually stronger, and so the slope goes in a different direction as for a CFT, or it would be like if you had like non-unitary operators. And then if you do it in like n equals, you can make like a, or you can make specific combinations that exactly cancel out this anomalous dimension, or between the beta function and the anomalous dimension. So you can kind of play around with these things and get behavior that's a little bit different than in conformal theories. So you can kind of have some games by playing with the quark gluon fraction. You have many consistency relations coming from the factorization in, I don't know where the best picture is, but coming from factorization in various limits. So in particular, this is related. So in this, like when it looks like this, it relates to a product of a two-point. So you can really just, like let's say these are really energy detectors and there's more general ones. Then what it factorizes into in this limit is essentially an energy, or it's a two-point function of an energy operator and an energy squared operator, and then this two-point function of those. And so they obey a whole variety of factorization conditions, which are quite constraining on their structure. Yeah. It's not zero. It's just it factorizes into a product of lower point functions that you know.
I have a very naive question. So you do this for jets. In principle, I don't see like an obstacle you need for like really coupled particles.
And
like how would it look like? If you do something like very energetic for the electric gauge.
Good. That would be, if you could really go to extremely high energies, that would also be interesting to do. But so where these really gain you is when you have very high multiplicity. Because if you really have like an exclusive number of decays, then you can just measure the exclusive amplitude. And so these are nice once you have very high multiplicity states. And so if you could like had some very high energy collider where you really are like radiating many, many, many Ws, then you'd see the exact same thing almost as. Because you can think of, I mean, like a kind of crappy model for confinement is just Higgsing the theory. And so like by I, the shape would not look that much different here. This would just be at the electroweak scale. And so you get there, if you were at very high energy, you get a scaling where these are really like dictated by the electroweak anomalous dimensions. And then you get some scale. So it's almost always like above the mass gap, you will always get this universal scaling.
Are there questions on Zoom? OK, so if there are no further questions, we can thank the speaker again.